From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for October the 8th, 2017. Yes, Chicago Marathon Sunday in the city. Time for our weekly look at politics from City Hall to the State House and off to Washington, D.C. Grab that Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, quite a day here in Chicago with the Chicago Marathon. Good luck to all the runners out there. Weather is just perfect. And I'm saying that as somebody who doesn't take part in running, if I can help it. Is that a fair statement?
Not even a nice, easy jog. Huh?
In my day, but not anymore. I mean,
I used to enjoy running when I was in college.
Why?
And I was in my 20s.
Why?
I don't know. I guess.
The solace?
As a solace? Well, maybe. But you know how, you know, if you, in order to graduate, you have to have a certain amount of hours of a given subject and so forth. Well, we had to have.
Wait, you got credit hours for running?
We got credit hours for physical education in college. And one of the courses was a running class.
Running 202.
Yeah, something
what's,
like that.
What's That's running right. 101? Put the left foot in front of the right foot?
But how about this? How about this? The goal of the course that was set up by the instructor, who was a really good guy, by the way, you know, because he knew he was dealing with people like me who just ran across the room to change the channel on the TV set. Before we had remotes, yes. The goal was if you could do 2 miles in 15 minutes, that you had reached the goal for the class. I did it. I got an A, and I enjoyed it. I thought, hey, this isn't so bad. I enjoy this moving right along here. Outside, nice, fresh air. Yeah, you know, I'm pumped now. I'll see you guys later. I'm going to go run.
You noticed the silence that just followed all of that as you explained that.
I did. Yeah.
you got college credit for running 2 miles in under 15 minutes.
I got an A out of the course. Yep. I can show you the transcript.
If I were you, I would keep that transcript in my pocket to show everybody. This is how I made it through college.
Hey, it looked good on the resume.
You put it on the the college did. Did you put the running on the resume?
No.
No. Well, that's I never knew that. But really, you don't do any of that anymore.
No, I don't. I'm lucky if I can make the jog across State Street to get to.
Come on. You're somewhat athletic.
Somewhat. Somewhat.
Okay, you're conditionally athletic.
The 2 miles in 15 minutes? No, I don't think I could do that now.
No. I bet you could.
You think so?
Yes. I'm challenging you now.
All right.
I bet you could do it.
When we meet at this time next week, I will give you a full report.
Well, I mean, see, like, I thought I was going to be smart in high school. I was, played some goalie in ice hockey, and I thought they were just starting a soccer team. I'm going to be a goalie. I'm not going to be one of those guys that runs up and down the field and wears themselves out. I'm going to, I just have my area there to guard and protect. That lasted till the first day of practice when they made all of us run.
You were not exempt.
Yeah, I really outsmarted myself on that one. I have to tell you. Oh, man.
Sam, are you a runner?
No.
No.
No, 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 no.
You never did do any running or jogging on a regular basis?
In grade school when we had to, but
okay.
No, I was never
after that,
a runner.
Nothing outside of that.
Nope,
okay.
I have more important things to do, Swanee.
Can I say I ran from my TV in the bottom of the eighth inning of the ball game last night?
Wow. Yeah.
I ran away from that.
Disappointing.
It really was. I mean, That's one of those games where you figure now everything's kind of all settled in. It's 3-1. And then it's 3-3.
That was my feeling.
That was like the all-time Cubs moment, wasn't it? And like maybe throw last year out the window. That's like what the Cubs do.
Yes, exactly.
Not to take away the World Series, but that was like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's supposed to happen.
Right. And
that's the feeling I got from the Cub fans that I was around. Like, oh, well, it was expected.
It's a Cubs moment. Yeah, there's no doubt. And but, I mean, you got the marathon going today. Tomorrow, you've got the Cubs at home.
Then the Bears.
And then the Bears at night.
And the Blackhawks.
And the Blackhawks, which another great win last night, 5-1. They're on fire. And I'm almost kind of scared because it's too early in the season to be this good. But after that shellacking of the Penguins, 10-1, I think first time they put up a 10 spot since like 1988.
Yep.
So, I mean, unbelievable. But
15 goals in 2 games.
Which is, I believe, that they've never done that in the first 2 games of a season.
And they've only given up 2.
Right.
15-2, the edge.
And that's kind of what's great about it is everybody, including me, we were all worried about the defense. Well, hey, if we can score 10 goals a game, you know.
Should be okay.
Yeah. There, you know, that's, I mean, it, just phenomenal. Just and it was great on the TV broadcast last night to see Eddie Olczyk, too. Back at the rink, and obviously, you know, going through his treatments and things. But, I mean, all of our best wishes go out to him and want him back in the booth very, very soon. You know, it's been so crazy. And then, you know, this past week, and Sam, right after the show last Sunday, you headed out to Vegas and got to kind of see firsthand the trauma and aftermath that was going on out there. And I had known that my eldest daughter was out in Vegas. I didn't know really that she was staying at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, and she left there about 3:00 Sunday afternoon. You know, this stuff really, I talk about it all the time. And here in Chicago, and of course, we have our daily episodes of gun violence, but when you see it get that close and you're not even a victim, I mean, what those people are going through out there, and still there's no rationale for it. The investigation continues about the shooter. I mean, there's just, I don't know anymore. I don't know what to say about it anymore. I mean, Sam, what was the mood like out there?
Well, as you can imagine, extremely tragic. I think the most eerie moment of the whole trip was that late Sunday night, early Monday morning, when you look out over your hotel room and you look down on the strip and it's empty.
Mm-hmm.
No people, no cars. And every time you're in Vegas, it's the most hopping place in the world.
24 hours.
I mean, people are walking all over the place the whole night. 24/7, and to see it empty and to see all these people fleeing from the strip, and then to get back to your hotel and nobody's gambling, nobody's having dinner, drinks, anything like that, it's super weird. And you know, it's sort of numbing to even think about it. They have to go back and think about it.
Well, it's kind of like the, you know, the normal that's Las Vegas, and now, you know, is this kind of the stuff of the new normal? That's the scary factor, and we can't let it get that way. That's part of the problem. I spoke with on Friday, spoke to Governor Rauner about his response, and of course condolences to the victims, as he said, and said we should have a conversation. And I said, well, where do you start the conversation? What are you for? And that conversation that he and I had at a press conference basically turned into the governor saying that he did not have an obligation to talk about issues in every issue that's going on in Washington. That's what the governor of the state of Illinois had to say. So here you at least have Republicans talking about doing away with these bump stocks that turn semi-automatic weapons into automatic weapons. You know, there seems to be some movement in Washington, something that's kind of rare. But we all have an obligation. We all have an obligation to talk about this and do more than just talk about it, but to act upon it as well. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Time for our weekly spin through national politics and, of course, reaction continuing to last weekend's deadly shooting at a concert in Las Vegas by a sniper at the Mandalay Bay Casino and Resort. How many times can a president express condolences over these gruesome acts? Well, here's a compilation from Columbine to Las Vegas.
Last night, a gunman opened fire on a large crowd at a country music concert.
Virginia Tech.
In a movie theater.
In Littleton.
And for many of you here today, it was the worst day of your lives.
The federal government stands ready to do whatever is necessary
to assist
local law enforcement, the schools, the families, the entire community.
And we ask a loving God to comfort those who are suffering today.
Scripture teaches us the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit.
St. Paul reminds us that we all see things in this life through a glass darkly, that we only partly understand what is happening.
In the hard days to come, that community needs us to be at our best as Americans, and I will do everything in my power as president to help.
We pray for the entire nation to find unity and peace, and we pray for the day when evil is banished.
And as you draw closer to your own families in the coming days, I ask you to reach out to those who ache for sons and daughters who will never come home.
I can only say tonight that the prayers of the American people are with you.
Now, President Trump visited Las Vegas, met with the victims of the shooting, their families, and with first responders, and offered his condolences.
The mass murder that took place on Sunday night fills America's heart with grief. America is truly a nation in mourning. I visited the hospital earlier today where many victims are still recovering from their wounds, and we ask God to ease their suffering and to speed their healing. We pray for the recovery of the injured and those injured officers who so bravely threw themselves into danger when duty called. And we grieve the loss of the law enforcement personnel who were killed in this vicious attack. Many families tonight will go to bed in a world that is suddenly empty. The people they so dearly love were torn away from them forever. Our souls are stricken with grief for every American who lost a husband or a wife, a mother or a father, a son or a daughter. We know that your sorrow feels endless. We stand together to help you carry your pain. You're not alone. We will never leave your side.
That's President Trump from his visit to Las Vegas. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Doug House. Doug is the chairman of the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association, and the group just issued its endorsement for governor. We'll talk to him about the Democratic primary for governor. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to Greg Bays. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. This is Manufacturing Month in Illinois and around the nation. And we'll talk to him about the state of manufacturing in Illinois. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll speak to Republican State Representative Peter Breen of Lombard. Representative Breen is the Illinois House Republican floor leader. And we'll talk to him about the continued fallout from Governor Rauner's decision to sign a bill to expand taxpayer-subsidized subsidize abortion to women on Medicaid and under state employee health insurance. That's all coming up.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here of Chicago Tribune, here in the beautiful Tribune Tower, the Allstate Showcase Studio. We've been talking a little bit about what happened last week in Vegas, and we have the NRA now saying it's willing to talk about things like bump stocks that allow a semi-automatic weapon to operate like an automatic firearm, raising the question of will there be some action in Washington. Illinois Democratic Senator, Senior Senator Dick Durbin, says the nation should treat gun violence as a health crisis.
We've seen Democrats and Republicans join together and pass meaningful laws to deal with public health crises like opioid addiction. We have to do the same for this public health crisis. And I'm sorry to report to you that a recent nominee for Surgeon General of the United States was almost denied that opportunity because he was bold enough to say that this is a public health crisis. Gun violence is a public health crisis. It certainly is. There's no single law or policy that would prevent every tragic shooting, as there's no single law or policy that would end a heroin overdose. But let's start working together to do something. We can't stop the shootings that have already happened in Las Vegas, in Chicago, in Roseburg, Oregon, and across the nation. We failed to respond in time for those victims and their families. But if we work together, we can stop shootings in the future.
That's Illinois Democratic Senior Senator Dick Durbin. Joining me now on the phone is Doug House. Doug is president of the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association, and the association met yesterday in Springfield, where it's fall meeting, where it issued its endorsement of J.B. Pritzker as its choice for the Democratic nomination for governor next year. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rick. It's good to be with you this morning.
So tell us about the vote and tell us about the decision-making process that was involved here.
Well, the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association is made up of 102 county chairmen from across the state of Illinois. On September the 11th, their executive committee of 22 county chairs met and approved a process that included the submission of credentials by each candidate interested in the endorsement, and then the procedures that would take place for the election. They also, or the endorsement, they also set a time and a place for that endorsement.
And, I mean, you had, in September, you had recommended that Pritzker be the endorsed candidate. You had encouraged all of the candidates to get out and go visit the counties and make themselves known. What, in your view, makes Pritzker different than the other candidates for the nomination?
Well, you're right. Very early on, we asked all of our chairmen to take their time, not to get in too big of a hurry about endorsements, give these candidates a chance to get out around the state and become known, get to know them, let them get to know our state. Very different state from one end to the other or from across one side to the other. So the issues vary greatly. So it's very important for whoever our candidate was to get out and really know the hardships or the pains that the people across the state were experiencing. And what we've seen, and I think what was proven out through the vote yesterday, was that J.B. Pritzker traveled the state and seen what the impacts of the failures of the Ronner administration have been, how the school systems were hurting, how people were out of work, how border communities were facing flight from our state as a result of some of the economic hardships and poor decisions made by the governor. And he was able to articulate a message that was resonating in those communities and with our county chairs. And so he's seen that in the vote yesterday. The vote that was taken, J.B. Pritzker received 65 votes. Chris Kennedy received 17. There were eight that voted for no endorsement. for a total of 90 of the 102 that were actually had voted. There are some, it's a large state, some of them couldn't travel as far or had things that come up and didn't participate. But even if you were to collect all of the other votes, which total 37, JB still would have been the very clear winner. He received more than 70% of those voting, and I would tell you that I believe very strongly that that number would have been considerably higher had we been able to get 100% participation yesterday.
Well, Doug, you're also the Rock Island County Democratic Chairman, and as I said earlier, you encourage candidates to get out and around the state. Do you get the sense of that, and I'm talking generally, not just Pritzker, but do you get the sense generally, given that all but Bob Diber from Madison County, do you get the sense that these candidates from this area here in Chicagoland truly get downstate and those issues of diversity that have to be addressed?
It's a lot to get your head around as a candidate, and they are all have been trying. But none have had the success that JB has. And it has a great deal to do with his demeanor and his ability to engage with constituents and with other people. He has an empathy towards people who are going through a hardship or a difficult time. But he's a good listener. When he's out there on the stump, or out in the field talking to people across our state, he listens to what their issues are and what their concerns are, and he has an ability to connect that is very special.
Well, given the problems that Democrats had in the presidential election, particularly in downstate and rural areas, do you get any sense that those, that anger that existed there, that helped fuel Trump, that's changed at all, and that people are going to be looking at Democrats next year?
I think the reason people are looking at Democrats a lot more and a lot more closely and listening to our message is because it's a consistent message over time. Bruce Rauner is much like the clock that is broken. He's right twice a day out of that entire spectrum of time that he could have been right. He's on every side of every issue. And so eventually he's going to be right on an issue at some point in time or another and can argue that he was. But it can also be argued that he was wrong the entire time. If you look at just the HB 40, he's been everywhere on that to everyone.
That's the abortion rights expansion bill, HB 40.
Correct. The right to work legislation, early on he met with labor and talked with labor people, and he was going to be supportive of working men and women, and he wasn't. So there are a lot of things that he's been all over the place on, and so that's causing people to take a second look. I believe that we can compete very strongly across the entire state of Illinois with J.B. Pritzker. His message does resonate. He has been downstate extensively. I've traveled the state from one end to the other, and it is a different state. The voters have very different issues. You get down into southern Illinois and coal country and the hardships that they face through their lost jobs, and you were talking about guns. You get down into deep southern Illinois, it's very much a culture. Fathers and sons grow up with their parents hunting, and even sisters hunt deer. And so there's it's a different type of a culture in that regard, and they view guns differently. But obviously in the inner cities of Chicago, we've had issues in other large communities here in Rock Island County. We've experienced gun violence and understand the need for responsible gun legislation. So there's complexities to that. I think JB understands those.
We're speaking to Doug House. He's the president of the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pierce from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. And joining me on the phone is Doug House. He's the president of the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association. And Doug, we have a call from Ron who asks a question that I've also been hearing from a number of, I want to say, rank and file Democrats. Just a question about who these candidates are that are running for governor. Ron?
Yeah, good morning, Rick. Yeah, Doug, two quick questions. What does it say about the state of the Democratic Party when both of the leading candidates have no government experience? You know, where about the individuals from the party who have experience, who should have been elevated to this position? My second question, or is it a perception that the citizens are just totally frustrated and disgusted probably with both parties and looking, you know, outside of regular government elected officials? Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Ron. Doug?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think it's, you know, that it's partly what's been responsible for some of the failures that Bruce Rauner has had for his lack of experience in government. Contrastly, in the two apparent front runners, in J.B. Pritzker and Chris Kennedy, both of them have had governmental experience. J.B. Pritzker had worked and spent time in his youth coming out of college. He worked and had interned within United States Senator Alan Dixon's office and had worked in government in that respect and continued to stay involved in government and has interacted with government within his business and in the efforts that he's done there. Chris Kennedy, I know, has served as president of the University Board for the state of Illinois, arguably a very complex and large governmental agency that he would have had to administer with a large variety of issues, dealing with budgets, dealing with organized labor, dealing with faculty, issues of the student body. And that's a statewide institution that would have had him working with the governor or legislature. But our candidates do have government experience. So I feel pretty good about them. Senator Biss obviously has served, introduced legislation, been active there. Alderman Pouar, you know, we're talking about one of the largest cities, not just in our country, but in the world, working within their governmental institution. So I do feel pretty good about it. But what he says is true. People are looking outside of conventional politics. And I think our candidates offer that as well. They offer a good vision. You know, obviously, I feel JB's vision is the best for the state, but we have a progressive vision. And I want to say that we have great candidates up and down throughout our governor's candidates. These are good people who have dedicated themselves to public service. The endorsement from the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association was about letting people know who we feel is the best candidate and the strongest candidate that will give us the strongest and best opportunity to take back the governor's office, to put a progressive agenda forward that is beneficial to the people. We're not telling the voters what they have to do. We don't have control over that system. That vote belongs to you. But having watched these candidates closely, we believe that this candidate, J.B. Pritzker, provides us the best opportunity to win.
Well, Doug, what you said just kind of rolls into my next question here, and is that among some of the progressives, there are questions about things like slating and endorsements, and that, you know, that's kind of old school politics, old school machine politics, and that, you know, among the more progressive faction in the party, that they want a more liberalization of the party, a more democratization of the party, in their words.
Yeah, and I, you know, I agree with that. To speak to that myself, I mean, that's what I come out of myself. I worked for a congressman and became involved in politics working for a congressman, Lane Evans. Lane Evans served with Bernie Sanders in the Congress, and still Lane Evans was the most liberal congressman on two separate occasions while having served with Bernie Sanders. He was a very forward-thinking populist, and I agree with that. But I do think that it's important that leaders within our party not sit on their hands and not just solely sit on the sidelines. It's important to look back at history and what has happened in Illinois in our party. I've been involved as a precinct committeeman since I was a young man at 23, and I'm now 57. But during that period of time, there have been occasions when the party leaders or elected officials did not communicate who our candidates were and took it for granted that the public would support the best candidate in a field. At one instance, on the extreme instance, we had an entire field of LaRouche candidates become nominated to represent our party as Democrats. They did not represent it. They were a very extreme element. So the Democratic Party had to run as candidates outside of their own party, as independent candidates. Now, that's the extreme of it. We don't have that within this instance. But I think it's always important that as leaders, we share where we feel the best opportunity to win is at and who we think best represents the field of candidates.
Also I'm sorry, go ahead, Doug.
I was just going to say I've talked with many groups, Democratic Socialists of America within the state of Illinois, Indivisible People within Illinois, and other liberal factions of our party. Very first thing that many of them bring up is wealth. And I don't believe in order to represent our party that a vow of poverty must be taken, this is only one element of the person. It's about values. If you look at Bruce Rauner's values, there is a huge lack and a disconnect between working men and women in our state. If you look at the values of J.B. Pritzker and our other candidates, they by far and away represent what working men and women are seeking in a candidate for governor.
And frankly, and I was going to say, because there is that part of the party that raises questions about, you know, is this just about having the candidate with the resources that can go toe-to-toe with Bruce Rauner and could also, you know, help build a party infrastructure the same way that Rauner revitalized the Republican infrastructure?
Well, if you look at the chairman's organization, these are individual leaders in each of these counties across the state, each of them with experience in recruiting candidates and running candidates for local office up to mostly legislative offices, but are also collectively involved together in supporting candidates for statewide office. And when they meet these candidates and they talk to them, first, they have to have shared values. Second, they have to demonstrate organization. Third, they have to be able to take a message and have it resonate within their constituents. And lastly, they need to be able to raise the money and or resources to be able to get out there and be competitive, whether that's for a county clerk's office, a recorder's office in your county, a township office, or legislative. Our candidates are all working hard for governor candidates. There's only one candidate that possesses all of those skills, and that's J.B. Pritzker.
That's Doug House. He's president of the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association. Doug, thank you very much for getting up with me this morning.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. It was good to be with you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we're going to speak to Greg Bays. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association as we commemorate Manufacturing Month in Illinois and around the country.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We've got Greg Bays is going to be up shortly, but I want to play a couple of cuts here about some of the news last week. Very interesting. We had reports from NBC News that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is on the firing line. NBC reporting that he became so irked by the president recently that he called the president a moron. Now, at an unscheduled news conference, Tillerson wouldn't say if he said it.
I'm not going to deal with petty stuff like that. I mean, this is what I don't understand about Washington. Again, you know, I'm not from this place, but the places I come from, we don't deal with that kind of petty nonsense. And it is intended to do nothing but divide people. And I'm just not going to be part of this effort to divide this administration.
So amid all of the turmoil and expectations that Tillerson might be leaving the cabinet sooner than later, retiring Senator Bob Corker, a Tennessee Republican, says that he understands the Secretary of State's frustration.
I think Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and Chief of Staff Kelly are those people that help separate our country from chaos. And I support them very much. I don't know what he may have said after the briefing. I see what's happening here. I deal with people throughout the administration, and he, from my perspective, is in an incredibly frustrating place where, as I watch, okay, and I can watch very closely on many occasions, he ends up not being supported in the way that I would hope a Secretary of State would be supported.
That's Tennessee Senator Bob Corker. Well, joining me now on the phone is Greg Bays. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and this is Manufacturing Month in Illinois as well as across the nation. And this is always kind of a time when we talk to Greg about, you know, what is the state of manufacturing in this state. Greg, thanks for joining me this morning.
Mr. Pearson, good to be with you.
What is the state of manufacturing?
Well, we have a lot of challenges in this state, but let's also remind ourselves it employs over 600,000 people in this state. It generates 13% of the state's gross domestic product. Manufacturing, as always talked about, one manufacturing job creates two jobs in other sectors of our economy. Illinois has always been a very, very strong manufacturing state. Between that, mining and agriculture, it's what built this state. It still employs an awful lot of people and generates a lot of activity. With that being said, as we've talked about lots of times on this show, Rick, and you have written about, manufacturers face challenges in this state because of the high cost of regulatory environment and other items, and it's the kind of thing that we should be changing, and we should be, always protecting this sector because of its importance. And manufacturers, unfortunately, do have the opportunity to have choices, whether they'll continue to grow their business, put capital into their facilities and things of that nature, or can they do it more efficiently in other parts of the country in the Midwest? And we see that occurring all the time.
Well, we look at the kind of stagnant rate of growth in the Illinois economy. And, you know, certainly the state has its challenges, and after having gone through the epic budget battle and those kinds of things. But, it's those kinds of things that seem to take all the oxygen out of everything. And it doesn't, the politicians, whatever, they may talk, but they don't actually look at things about where to grow the economy.
Well, Illinois seems to always, and certainly seemingly in the last decade, want to make it more difficult for job creators. I don't care if it's manufacturers, retailers, or others in the economy. The little issue that's been going on here in Cook County most recently in the soda tax is just one example of that, of what businesses face in this state. Politicians need to, and as the soda tax, I think, demonstrates, need to understand that there is a tipping point, that voters will finally say enough is enough. And you only need to go to various places in Cook County, in the collar counties, certainly downstate. And you see what happens to communities when major manufacturers leave their community. Galesburg lost the Maytag refrigeration unit a few years ago, the kind of damage that was done to their economy. Peoria, you drive through that community and you see while Caterpillar still a major portion of that community, you see where other places in that community have lost manufacturing facilities. Go to the west side, the south side. It's not a coincidence that the areas of high crime and stagnant growth in Chicago occur in areas that used to be the manufacturing centers of the city. So there is a direct correlation between those kinds of jobs and what happens to a community when they leave. And Manufacturing Month is a time of celebration of what manufacturing means to the country, President Trump, and the nation. It certainly seems to be higher on the priority of trying to protect American jobs, create American jobs here. It's a time to celebrate that and highlight that. But unfortunately, we in Illinois have got to point out these problems and point out some of the other things that aren't just as obvious. The fact that baby boomers are retiring at a rate and those people who are involved in manufacturers having a hard time to replace those jobs because people are not going into that arena. So that's what the month is about. Jay Timmons and I will be at the City Club on Tuesday talking about these various issues of the lack of training programs to get people ready for the manufacturing jobs of the future. A real revolution is going on out there in that, and Illinois and the nation needs to be prepared for that.
I want to talk to you more about that revolution. We're speaking with Greg Bays. He's the CEO and president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
8:19 on this Sunday morning. This is your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and I'm speaking with Greg Bays, president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, as we mark Manufacturing Month in Illinois and across the nation. And right before the break, Greg, you were touching on the issue of the revolution that's coming. And I think I know what you're getting at is the digitalization, automation of manufacturing going at leaps and bounds, and that the jobs that were traditionally considered manufacturing jobs are now requiring all new skill levels.
A tremendous level of new skill, and I believe that the young people of Illinois, young people of this country, are up to the challenge. They've just got to be introduced to what those opportunities are, and that's what we haven't done a good enough job of making sure that young people as early as in seventh and eighth grade understand that there is a career opportunity to be in this arena. And it is very high tech. It is very much related to the skills that young people display today and what they are looking at, how they're getting their information. The digital revolution that's occurring inside manufacturing facilities is just phenomenal. And our school systems, our community college systems, are beginning to realize that and providing the kind of training and opportunities for these folks. I was at the College of DuPage just last week, and they talk about the number of people who are coming back in as sort of the restart of their career in their late 20s, early 30s, that, you know, they got the bachelor's degree and studied philosophy in school, but realized it wasn't carrying their career as far as they should be doing. So the ability to come back in, learn what the machining operation is about, the kind of needs that our companies have all over this state. And when I say about introducing young people to it, sort of the cool things that manufacturers do. As an example, we have a manufacturer up in northern Illinois who was part of the Mars rover team back a few years ago, and put parts of the gearbox in that particular piece of machinery, and they had everyone come in before they sent that piece of those gears off to NASA to touch that piece of equipment so that their DNA would be today on Mars. It's that kind of things that we've got to be able to introduce young people to so that they sort of see that this arena is sort of cool, and it's not this idea that you put on a pair of coveralls, a lunchbox, and walk into a dark and dirty facility. These are high-tech, must have the ability to be able to understand code, be able to write code, to be able to work with the machines that are in these facilities. And if we do a better job at that, the United States is able to compete with anybody in the world as far as being efficient and the kinds of changes that are there. And that's the challenge that lawmakers face and all of us face in getting those folks prepared for that.
Well, why haven't we done a better job of it?
Well, I think that there has been, it's a little bit like the old song, you don't realize what you've got till it's gone. And as we have seen some of the changes occur, I think people are now waking up to the notion that if we're not training, I mean, when I said 600,000 people in this state directly involved, we have 30,000 people a year right now just retiring as the age of workers hit the 65 and older time period. We have got to be replacing them. We're not going to replace all 30,000 a year because there are going to be efficiencies. And when people get concerned about manufacturing that, quote, robots are going to replace and the jobs are going to just disappear, well, robots don't walk into a room. They don't get there themselves. They don't program themselves. They don't repair themselves. And the kinds of jobs that we can have in the future. And one other thing I will point out, Rick, an average manufacturing job in this state is a $74,000 a year job with full benefits. When you talk about some of the kinds of different specialties that we have in this state, let's say in the pharmaceutical industry in the up in the Lake County area as an example, those jobs are $100,000-plus average pay. So these are good, solid, middle-class jobs that can grow our communities, allow people to buy a home, educate their children, do the kinds of things that, quote, our parents, when they built the strong middle class of this country, did in the 60s and the 70s. So I think it is changing. I think people are listening. President Trump has brought this issue to the fore when he talks about the wanting to make sure that manufacturing is strong. He, in the last just couple of weeks, as you may have seen, has appeared in various manufacturing facilities in highlighting that. So it really does come with education. It does come with people understanding that it's important and groups like ours and others continuing to beat that drum.
But once again, with the education component, and you and I have talked about this in the past, where, you know, it seems like every president has talked about, you know, the trying to do this linkage with community colleges and those kinds of partnerships and developing those skills and those specialty skills. But, you know, it seems anecdotal. I'm not sure that it really is as big as it should be.
Well, I think you're right. I think we do have to keep pounding the table. The Obama administration, and we're a part of a Department of Labor grant that is working on apprenticeships. You're not going to change the United States model into the German model, to where you have seventh and eighth graders really picking tracks and moving forward and being apprentice widely used in this country. But we are attempting, along with the German-American Chamber of Commerce, to enlighten people on that opportunity. We're charged with attempting to put 600, I know it doesn't seem like a lot, but it is a more difficult task than you might imagine, and getting 600 apprentices located inside manufacturing facilities across the state and utilizing those as cohorts as they move through a program in those companies to become full-time employees. It won't change overnight, but it's programs like that that will, I think, open the eyes of people.
So, as part of Manufacturing Month, I know that there's lots of events going on. As you say, it's a, you know, a celebration. But, you know, with that program you just described, that would seem like a natural kind of way to get young people integrated into what manufacturing means today.
Well, one of our challenges there, the average age of an apprentice in Germany is 17. The average apprentice in the United States is 24. Usually what happens, someone is going on a direction, make a change, and come back into that. It is something that you would think that people would latch onto. But this has to go into the elementary, secondary level schools. Guidance counselors, as an example, have to be brought in and understand the opportunities in their community. And it's not just a monolith across the state in one thing. The pharmaceutical manufacturing, the food processing opportunities in the steel and metal sectors of the manufacturing sector are all different. And each community may well have, a different ability to introduce it to their school system. So it's not just as easy as a governor issuing a policy and it just taking hold. It is going to take some time to make these changes.
That's Greg Bays. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Greg, thanks so much for getting up with me this morning.
Good to be with you. I'm glad I got to stay out of the crowd down there.
That's exactly right. We know better.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Greg. We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Republican State Representative Peter Breen of Lombard. Representative Breen is the Illinois House Republican floor leader, and we'll talk about what's going on in the Illinois Republican Party.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Just a couple of notes here. I was checking on the text line and want to give a special shout-out to Wally. I'm listening to you while I am in Shanghai for a few weeks. Thanks for being my lifeline to Illinois politics while I'm here. I mean, who says this isn't a interconnected digital world that we live in? I also want to give a special shout-out to one of the show's most devoted listeners and my good friend Aunt Fran, who is turning 90 years old up in Madison, Wisconsin, and had a chance to get together with her and some of her friends yesterday, and we're all thinking about you, and have a very, very happy birthday. Well, joining me now on the phone is Peter Breen. He's the Republican state representative from Lombard. He's also the Illinois House Republican floor leader. Representative Breen, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick.
How are things in the Lilac Village this morning?
It is sunny and bright. As my lifelong Chicagoan wife told me once I moved her west of 294, she said, you know, it's a gorgeous morning in the land of milk and honey here at DuPage County.
And no major road closures because there's no marathon going on out in Lombard today.
Right. No marathons this morning.
Well, I wanted to have you on the program because obviously we're seeing almost daily, you know, reports of divisions in the Republican Party, and one of the main issues, or perhaps the trigger, being the governor's signature on what was known as HB 40. That's the bill that would expand taxpayer funding for abortions to women who are covered by Medicaid as well as state employee health insurance. And the governor, as a candidate, had responded to a questionnaire saying that he supported the goals of such legislation and vowed to work for it. In April, in the midst of the state's budget impasse, apparently in an effort to try to secure unity among you and your Republican colleagues against the Democratic legislative majority, he assured that he would veto the legislation. Then he went ahead and signed it. The fallout seems to continue. Talk about a potential primary challenge. Is it anything more than talk?
Well, and Rick, I mean, I think, you know, for your listeners of all parties, you want to see a vibrant and robust Republican Party, the same way you want to see a vibrant, robust Democratic Party, in order to have the interchange of ideas and principles from which hopefully we can provide the policies that can move the state forward. We're in a terrible space right now. The problem with what Rauner's done is that he did go back on his word. He had given his word to the people of the state and to the legislators and to the cardinal that he was going to veto this taxpayer-funded abortion. You're looking at 30,000 abortions becoming funded by tax dollars. And I know you had mentioned he had filled out a survey in the 2014 cycle, but that was actually a confidential survey. It was never revealed to the public. Instead, his public promise in the 2014 election was to have no social agenda. So he said, I'm pro-choice, but I'm going to do no social agenda, which most of us said, okay, you just don't rock the boat and let's focus on the economic problems facing the state. Republicans were, for the most part, willing to say, okay, fair enough, we can deal with that. So this was an utter reversal and a betrayal of his base. He had also just recently signed a bill that people believe turn our state into a sanctuary state, at least in some capacity. So that has been something that caused people some concern. And he went for 2 years with federal judges making the spending for the state, racking up all these billions of dollars in bills. Rauner had problems already. This signature really had fractures the entire Republican Party. I mean, Rauner had put a lot of deep roots in. He'd put his, if you'll forgive the expression, he has his tentacles in every part of the Republican Party all across the state because he's put so much money into it. And now he's fractured all of those tentacles. And it is, we're in a very bad spot right now. So, again, to your question, I think a primary challenge is inevitable. And there are good reasons for it.
Or do you think, and I know you can't speak for the entire Republican caucus in the House or Senate, but do you think those legislators that receive funding from Governor Rauner should give that money back?
Well, I mean, look, money that's been given has been given. It was already used in campaigns, and it's done.
At the time, you know, that was and quite frankly, as much as Republicans complain about Mike Madigan and the, you know, ensuring loyalty and all that kind of thing, you know, it also raised the question of Bruce Rauner and his money was doing the same thing of trying to ensure loyalty.
Well, and I might say, I mean, Rick, if you're I don't know if the governor has any friends left in the legislative caucuses, at least the rank and file. So when you're looking at that, I don't think anyone's going to accuse folks of loyalty to Rauner. I think you're going to see a lot of independence going forward. Your question goes to the broader point, which is Rauner has been putting a ton of money into many arms of the Republican Party, and what it's done is when you owe the bank for a house or whatever, you know, you're owned by the bank. The problem is if you own the whole village and the bank's loaning you that money, you know, you actually own the bank instead of the bank owning you. So Rauner, I mean, we have a really serious problem. Folks are depending on money from Rauner. At the same time, he's betraying our principles. So we're going to have a very difficult, we have to have a difficult family discussion within the Republican Party. Are we going to continue to stand with a guy just because he's writing big checks? I mean, if he wasn't writing these kind of checks, you think anybody anywhere in the Republican Party would still be with him for governor? That's a question I've asked, and I think the answer would be no.
Well, Leader Breen, who leads that discussion, that family discussion? Initiate that?
And that's a good point. You know, folks rail against the establishment. And the establishment is a flexible group, and to some extent it's folks who are active on the various issues that make up the Republican coalition. That's the fiscal issues, social issues, and other issues. It's folks who have the capacity and willingness to put their money where their mouth is and to give money in that way. Others who are elected officials, I know, you know, we're a part of that conversation, and that's what I've been trying to do since the governor. You know, he had his press conference Thursday a week ago. I went over to the press conference. I was denied entry. So I stood outside, and I laid out what some have called the indictment of Bruce Rauner. And so that, you know, that's the indictment's been laid out. And as to who then prosecutes the case to conclusion, I'm not sure.
Spoken like the lawyer that you are, Representative Breen. We're speaking with Republican State Representative Peter Breen from Lombard, the Illinois House Republican floor leader. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. We're speaking with Republican State Representative Peter Breen from Lombard. He is the Illinois House Republican floor leader. We're talking about the state of the Illinois Republican Party these days. And Leader Breen, as we touched on with the fact of the money that the governor has put into the Republican apparatus in a variety of ways, is this also just kind of a test of, you know, where are Republicans in Illinois these days?
Well, and that's the thing. I think Republicans as a voting bloc are probably pretty unified on their issues. I mean, I don't think that's really the I don't know that that is the issue. I mean, the problem is, I mean, Rauner has now gotten so far out of step with folks. He has become toxic and, I mean, radioactive is the word I've heard. In terms of for Republican elected officials and for Republican, you know, regular Republican voters. So that's really where we're at with him.
So when we look at, let's look ahead to the veto session, and there's been lots of chatter that this could be a very interesting veto session, because now that there's this apparent lack of allegiance to the governor, that maybe legislators who ideally should always vote their district interests will truly be more like a free agent and be able to do that, and are not encumbered by the thought that the governor might mount someone to run a primary challenge.
Well, and so you always vote your district, certainly, but there are plenty of bills where your district is up in the air or it doesn't have a strong feeling. And so, and particularly when you're in a legislative minority, in those times, it often is better for you to stick together, have a common message, because since you're in the minority, you really have to break through.
You're not driving the message.
Messaging.
Yeah, you're not driving the message.
You're going to have to find a spot. Right. So remaining united, when it's consistent with the interests of your districts, is often helpful. So the issue now, though, is we are concerned less about the governor's desires in that, and more about how do we, as a Republican caucus, move forward to present the best foot, present the best face, present the Republican principles that we agree on. I mean, you know, folks in our Republican caucus agree on about 80% of things. Some things we don't, though, and so there will be places where people may say, "Hey, you know, this is not really where I want to be," and so we're going to have some tough decisions and discussions about where do we want, you know, what course do we want to chart going forward as a Republican caucus.
Well, you know, I found it interesting the other day when, in light of what you said about Republicans, you know, being unified on most issues, is that, you know, in light of this turmoil, and the governor was explaining what he viewed the Republican Party stood for, but didn't mention that one of the planks of the state Republican Party platform was opposing taxpayer funding of abortions. But I also thought, you know, one of the issues in which I think Republicans are struggling with is what the governor stands for. And, you know, we know what his 44-point turnaround agenda has been, but what, you know, on issues, what do you stand for? Is that correct?
Certainly. And when you're looking, particularly when a guy looks you in the eye, he shakes your hand, makes a commitment to you, and then he flips around and lies. And it's only the latest in a series of things where you'd sit there and go, that doesn't seem consistent with your promise of no social agenda. You look at that, then you look at the fact that he is just cycling through staff members like crazy. And all these people were competent where they were before. They get with him, and all of a sudden, it's a bumbling. You know, I mean, you're making competent people look like they're bumblers. Hey, you know, at some point, it's not the people's fault. It's the boss's fault. And so that is where we are with the governor. And Rick, I've been trying to say, we need someone who will head the Republican Party, who can lead a cause, who is has got really the opposite qualities of Rauner in terms of, you know, being principled, being able to get a deal done, you know, being able to unify the party, none of which he can do and none of which he is.
Well, I mean, was an example of some of these problems the fact that in trying to put together a budget compromise or the school, even the school funding formula change, that he wasn't really in the room?
Not just not in the room, but actually actively being unhelpful. So on the budget, look, we had Republicans cave at the end. I am not going to excuse the behavior, and they have to answer to their districts for it. But had the governor shown some leadership over the prior 2 years to try to figure out a way to have our expenses match our revenues, just balance the budget, propose something, get something done. Had he had any leadership, you would not have seen those Republicans capitulating at the end.
So because there would have been something
blame off of them.
There would have been something to hang on to as
right.
here's an end game kind of
thing. We went for 2 years with federal judges allowed to make all the spending for the state, and they were spending $5 billion, $6 billion a year more than we were taking in. And I mean, the governor didn't lift a finger. He didn't go to court and say, "Hey, judge, we can't afford this," or, "Hey, judge, can we do this differently?" Or, "Hey, Democrats in the legislature, why don't we figure something out?" There was none of that from this governor. So we need someone to run for governor who can actually, again, have the principles. If you want to say you're a fiscal conservative, that means you don't spend more than you have. Where is that principle? You know, negotiation, being able to get work done to the other side, and then unifying. I mean, those are those three things. You've got to have that in our gubernatorial candidate going forward.
And I know you say, you know, we have a deadline of, I believe, the first week of December for filing for candidacy, that getting petitions is not going to be a significant, signatures on petitions is not going to be significant. But yet the clock is kind of ticking.
Absolutely. I mean, Rick, I know there are a number of people out there. I think any member of the General Assembly on the Republican side who voted against the tax increase, who voted against the sanctuary city, voted against taxpayer funding of abortion, I think nearly anyone, if they are properly funded and have an adequate campaign, can very easily make this petition requirement and beat the governor in the primary. I'm knocking on doors. The number one person I hear about is Bruce Rauner, and folks are furious. So, I mean, the room is there. I do worry that, you know, we have some folks who may be looking at candidacies that don't have the ability to, you know, they might be principled, but they don't have the ability or the proven ability to be able to negotiate and get a deal done with the Democrats, nor are they the sorts of people who could unify the party. So I am worried about, you know, that maybe folks are saying, hey, we're just going to beat Rauner, and then we're going to get whacked in the general, or we just don't care about beating Pritzker in the general. I'm worried about that from a party standpoint.
Do you want to tell me?
That's where I'm at right now.
Do you want to tell me who you might be worried about among those names?
I don't want to mention that. I mean, I don't want to say I'm worried about a particular person's name. But if you want to talk about candidates, say go ahead. You can ask, and I'll either evade or I'll answer.
I actually think it's premature to talk about candidates at this point.
Okay.
I don't know if you share that view. I think there is name floating going on, as they call it.
Right. Well, again, I'm looking at it. The general election against J.B. Pritzker is going to be heavy money. There's going to be a lot of dirt slung. If the Republican Party if you don't have a nominee who is someone we can get behind and unify behind, kind of in an all hands on deck mode, we're going to lose, guaranteed. And if you lose, you risk, if you have the wrong candidate there, you risk having an Alan Keyes-style loss. So you're looking at a 20-point loss, and at which point J.B. Pritzker takes his $100 million and he starts using it in legislative races to make sure he has Democrat loyalists and has some cushion to get his agenda through the General Assembly, kind of as a reverse Rauner. So he buys a bunch of Democrat legislators and takes out the Republicans. So that we lose seats. I could see a really catastrophic result if you do have somebody that is in the general that we can't unify behind, who's maybe divisive, who is not shown an effective ability to negotiate with the Democrats, or who is not able to be principled.
After the party had just come out of the wilderness with Rauner's election.
We elected the one guy. I mean, we all thought he was competent because he'd done well in business. Apparently his skills for whatever type of business he, you know, was successful in do not transfer to government, or he himself doesn't have the temperament. The results are evident. I mean, look, we are not better off than we were 4 years ago with Bruce Rauner.
I'm going to have to leave it on that note. Republican State Representative Peter Breen from Lombard, the Illinois House Republican floor leader. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Doug House, the president of the Illinois Democratic County Chairman's Association, Greg Bays, president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and Republican State Representative Peter Breen from Lombard, the Illinois House Republican floor leader. Also want to thank all of you for listening, and I also want to do one big thank you, too. A big thank you to producer Jasmine, who this is her last time at the wheel,
Jazzy,
on the Sunday Spin.
Woo! Thank you.
And she moves along to greener pastures on the Bill and Wendy show. But, it's been great. There's something about dependability and consistency. And that may not sound great or anything. It is on a Sunday morning. It's like the backbone to make everything run. And that's jazzy. I mean, I don't have to worry about a thing when I come in here.
You'll always be a part of Sunday morning, Jasmine.
Oh, my goodness. I said I wasn't going to cry, but now I'm in tears. Oh, no. I love you guys. Thank you guys
so much.
I
normally try to drive politicians into tears. this is somewhat unique. Jazz, I can't say enough. Thank you so much, Rick. All you've done for me, for all of us here, and for the show.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much, guys, for putting up with me for so long. You guys could have said, no, we don't want Jasmine, but you guys.
Why would we not want Jasmine?
I don't know. But thank you guys so much once again. I'm not going to cry on air. I'm not going to do it.
I'm still going to write a poem about you.
Please do, Dave.
Let me cry, guys.
He's going to write that poem after he does the 2 miles in less than 15 minutes.
Right.
As part of his marathon. Well, Pete McMurray and Jane, you guys are in for Dean.
I'm tearing up now. I miss Jasmine already.
This is a wonderful moment right here.
That's nice.
Well, it's nice that we could have this touching moment before you come on.
Right. It's good to see you in person.
It's good to see you, as always.
Do you have your Blackhawks hat on?
Obviously, I do.
We expect them to score 5 goals every game now, right?
I'm thinking 800 easy.
They need to save some for the rest of the season. That's how I feel.
I don't believe that at all. Okay. They're just so hot
just
right now.
Just go.
Although someone described them, I think, last night as how the Hawks have just pummeled, two strong competitors. Now, no offense to the Columbus Blue Jackets, folks.
They're not strong.
They're not strong yeah. competitors.
My favorite moment last night is the Eddie O moment.
Yes, that was
wonderful.
Absolutely.
And I know he's been struggling with this whole cancer thing, but hopefully he'll get through it.
And when he talked to Pat Foley about it, you could tell,
Foley got choked up and Foley gave him a tribute during the game. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
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 We're all praying for him.
Absolutely.
Have a great weekend. Good luck getting home. It'll take you 3 hours.
Yeah.
Because that's how long it took me to get here.